Copcast, episode 140, Sunday, September 13th, 2009.
The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
110 pursuit.
110's in pursuit, 2357, 1020, 110.
Welcome to Copcast, a weekly podcast where we discuss cop and tech issues. I'm Rich Shoemaker, and I'm coming to you from the Digital Command Center, located in the beautiful Blue Ridge Mountains of Salem, Virginia. And I want to thank you for taking your time to download and listen to this week's show. Well, last week, Michael graced us again with his presence, so I want to send him a big thank you for being my co-pilot. In fact, we had so much fun that again, I'd like to extend a similar invitation to our other listeners. If you have a decent microphone, all you need to do is install the free AOL Instant Messenger, and I'll give you an opportunity to join me as a co-host for a week. If you want to give it a try, just drop me a line at talkback@copcast.net. Now, if you hear some gunfire in the background, that's the Salem Police Department up there doing a little night fire this evening, so hopefully the microphone won't pick it up, but hell, it'll give us a nice realistic feel to this podcast. Well, I'm proud to say that my son has finally bought a house in Richmond, Virginia, so I'm spending most of my spare time helping him get settled in. And by getting settled in, I mean, of course, painting. You know, for me, painting ranks somewhere around, say, like sliding down a 50-foot razor blade into a puddle of alcohol. But you do what you got to do for your kids. So anyway, not much fun happening around this part of the country. As you probably know, I'm running a little bit late. This is not actually Sunday, September 13th. It's actually kind of like Monday evening, September 14th. But like I said, I've been kind of busy, so just didn't get time to get the show out on time this week. We'll try to do better next week. In other words, I don't have a lot of time to mess around with small talk tonight. I think my Copcast correspondents and I have worked pretty hard to put together another great show this week, even though we're pushed for time and we're running a little bit late. But before we do, let's take a minute to look in the mailbag and see what's in there before we head off to roll call for briefing. Well, this week, Clinton Smith wrote to address Michael's question last week about the Law Enforcement Explorer program. He wrote, "A side note to Michael, police explorers can also be called cadets here. My department has a small distinction between cadets and explorers. Explorers are all volunteer, and cadets are in the college, and they're also paid city employees. There are some cities and counties that have cadets that are all volunteer and are really explorers and go through all the same training. But I guess cadets sounds more official, so they choose that. It really depends on the city or county. So what happened to the rest of y'all? It seems like if I'm doing a show by myself, I rarely have much email to read for some reason. So here's your homework assignment. If you listen to the show from anywhere outside the United States, just drop me an email telling me where you live and how long you've been a listener. Pretty simple, right? So go ahead, do it now. We'll wait on you. Actually, we're not going to wait on you. But seriously, really, we really do like hearing from our listeners. So if you have a comment, a suggestion, or a good cop story, send us an email at talkback@copcast.net. Well, I regret to say that this week we didn't get a chance to talk with the two girls from Utah. A very dear friend of Shell's family passed away, and then, of course, I was out of town. So if you get a chance, swing by Cops Online and go to Hell's Bunny's page and leave her a note of condolence on her wall. The girls will be back next week, but remember, you can always catch up with the two girls from Utah on Cops in Line. Just look for Hell's Bunny and Buckethead in the chat room, or just shoot them an email. Well, I think it's about time that we go ahead and move into the briefing room to talk about those offbeat stories that our legion of listeners have come to know and expect from Copcast. Item number one. James Timothy Buchanan of Panama City, Florida, was clever enough to use multiple IDs to obtain prescription pain pills. But he wins a spot in the stupid criminal category after he decided it was a good idea to show up for questioning at the Bay County Sheriff's Office with a stash of the pills in his pocket along with his false IDs. According to the report, the Sheriff's Department contacted Buchanan and requested that he come to the Sheriff's Office for questioning about a warrant that was issued on him. Apparently wanting to cooperate, Buchanan reported to the station, at which time the police served him with the warrant charging him with obtaining a false prescription. After his arrest, police searched him and found Lortab plus three Florida driver's licenses. Buchanan apparently doesn't have a prescription for Lortab, and in the state of Florida, it's also illegal to have more than one license. Buchanan now faces the original charge plus possession of more than one valid driver's license and possibly some more drug charges. What a bright boy. Item two. Two California men had what they thought was a great idea for making a few bucks. Breaking into a 40,000 square foot building and stealing copper wire from inside the vacant building. They ran into a little bit of a problem because they kind of picked the wrong time to break into the California building. When James Ayers, 26, and Frederick Galee, 38, decided to break into the building, the Antioch Police Canine Unit was using the building for a training exercise. A police officer was hiding inside the building for the police dog to practice trying to find him. When the canine officer shouted that a dog was about to be released and that anyone inside should come out or risk being bitten, Ayers surrendered immediately. The two were arrested on suspicion of commercial burglary. See, that's the kind of stuff that would happen to me if I decided to go into a life of crime. Some off-the-wall, ignorant, odd situation like that would arise, and I'd find my butt sitting in jail. There's no doubt in my mind. Item three. This one's out of Wyoming. Battling an intensely hot fire after a cargo truck crashed on a highway, emergency crews were surprised to find themselves suddenly fired upon by corks from exploding wine bottles inside. Wyoming Highway Patrol Lieutenant Scott Keene said the corks were popping out of the bottles like the old Jiffy Pop popcorn we grew up with. My troopers got hit in the arm with one. The fire Thursday was so intense it burned a trailer down to its axles, melted the tires, and damaged about 75 feet of pavement. Besides the heat and the flying corks, firefighters also had to deal with shattering bottles. Fortunately, no one was injured, and the truck driver escaped a fire. The wreck was likely caused by a locked brake or some type of hub malfunction. So I don't know if he's going to get charged or not, but there's not going to be any vino at the mill tonight. Item four. A man was arrested early after Knoxville, Tennessee police said he stole a cruiser while handcuffed, led them on a chase, and then finally crashed a car. The man was identified as Stephen Sieber, 20 years old. The incident began about 2:30 a.m. when officers were doing a drug-related investigation, and Sieber and two other men from Lake City area. Sieber was detained for possession of crack cocaine and marijuana. He was handcuffed behind the back and put in the back of the cruiser. He was told he'd be issued a misdemeanor citation and then released. When officers began dealing with the other men, Sieber somehow managed to get his handcuffs in front of him and then crawl through an opening in the cruiser's security screen. He got behind the wheel and drove off while being chased through the alley by an officer. He eventually left the roadway at a construction site, and officers found a cruiser down over an embankment. A canine officer found Sieber, who had gotten out of the cruiser and was hiding nearby in thick weeds. He was still handcuffed, of course. He'd been charged with narcotics possession, escape, auto theft, DUI, reckless driving, and a variety of other traffic-related offenses. Police said Sieber was interviewed before his chase, and he was kind of behaving belligerently and appeared to be on some type of narcotic. A blood sample was taken and will be sent to the lab for analysis. Item 5. South Auckland, New Zealand police are on the hunt for a polite robber wanted in connection with 5 armed holdups in the past month. The offenses began with a robbery of a Shell service station. After that, there were 4 more robberies at nearby businesses over about a 1-month period. 2 offenders were involved in one of the robberies, armed with a crowbar and a pistol. All the others were committed by a single offender with a silver and black pistol. A police spokesman said one interesting aspect of the offender is how polite he has been when demanding money, using words like please and thank you. Isn't that cute? I wish we had nicely mannered bad guys like that up here. Item 6. And this is a bunch of bull. Police in South Jordan, Utah, had to use tasers to tame a bull that escaped from its owner and knocked over an 80-year-old man. A bull escaped from its owner Wednesday in a Salt Lake City suburb, and others in the area tried to corral it. The bull knocked over an 80-year-old man who was trying to help. Police arrived and ended up using their tasers to subdue the animal. Eventually, the owner was able to get the bull into a trailer. The man was toppled by the bull suffered a cut and some bleeding. He went to the hospital as a precaution. Don't you love calls like this? Item 7. You would expect this one to come out of the United States, but this story is actually from the Netherlands, you know, home of Amsterdam and botanical tolerance and, you know, among other things. Dutch police swooped down on what they thought was an illegal cannabis farm. Police announced that they had discovered about 47,000 cannabis plants with an estimated street value of 4.4 million euros, which is about like $6.3 million. Unfortunately, what they actually found was a scientific experiment run by a local university. The plants were part of a legal experiment on the suitability of cannabis fibers for the production of textiles, paper, and synthetic materials. Simon Bink, spokesman for the university, said, "The project had been underway for years, and it was in the final phase, which would have allowed us to introduce these new fibers into the market." More than half the plants were destroyed. Bink said the plants were unfit for cannabis production due to an extremely low content of THC, the psychoactive ingredient for soft drug use. The Netherlands decriminalized the consumption and possession of under 5 grams of cannabis in 1976, though the cultivation of marijuana still remains illegal. Item 8. Police in Kansas said 2 men attempting to steal landscaping rocks were foiled when the load shifted and their truck sank into the Arkansas River. The brown Ford Explorer was backed up to the river next to the Keeper of the Plain sculpture in Wichita just before 1:20 a.m. while the men loaded limestone landscape rocks into the truck. The load shifted once the men had put about 12 rocks inside, causing the truck to roll backwards into the river. Investigators said an address linked to the truck is apparently in the process of being landscaped, so, you know, that's how they kind of pieced this all together. Police said no arrest had been made, but they have identified a 45-year-old suspect. Item 9. This is definitely one of those you-got-to-be-shitting-me stories. A man from Georges Township, Pennsylvania, fired a cannon in his yard, sending a cannonball through the side of his neighbor's home. William Edward Macer, 54, allegedly fired his 80-pound French and Indian War replica cannon, sending a 2-pound lead ball into his neighbor's closet. The cannonball broke a window while going through the side of the unidentified neighbor's home. The projectile went through a wall and landed in a closet. No explanation was given for the errant shot, but Macer is a regular participant in battlefield reenactments. The incident resulted in reckless endangerment, criminal mischief, and disorderly conduct charges against Mazur. Finally, item number 10. And this is out of Seattle, Washington. Prosecutors say a Kent man coerced his ex-girlfriend to have sex with him by threatening to post nude photos of her online if she didn't. Joshua G. White, 25, has been charged with extortion in King County Superior Court. Court documents say police learned of the alleged threats in June when the woman phoned the police. She said she agreed to have sex with him if he'd sign a statement agreeing not to post the photos, but his threats continued. The woman told police White had become increasingly irrational after she broke off a relationship with him. Prosecutors requested White remain in jail on $25,000 bail, but of course he was released on his own recognizance after his arrest. Yeah, you know, nothing says I love you like a little extortion. Well, that'll about do it for this week's stories. I want to thank Sarah Roberts, Clinton, Drusilla Gothley, Bill Van Loon, Clifton Smith, and Sergeant TC, our Copcast correspondents for this week, for contributing stories that made this show special. Now, on to our Tales from George's Pocketbook. This week we have another great installment of the Tales from George's Pocketbook, our audio segment from our brother officers in Great Britain. This week, George teaches us another life lesson. You see, everyone has a bad week, even George. These are the times when absolutely nothing seems to go right, and just when you thought nothing else can go wrong, it does. So sit back and give old George a listen.
Welcome to another tale from George's Pocketbook. George is a frontline UK response officer dedicated to fighting crime, resolving family disputes in minutes that have taken years to break down, and getting in the faces of the social underclass. All events are real, and names and places have been changed to protect the innocent, not so innocent, and plain stupid.
The area car Mike 1 and a response car Mike 2-1, crewed by George and his latest probationer, had both taken a call to a personal attack alarm that had been set off in a house in a large suburban residential area. As the two cars flew through early evening traffic with their blue lights flashing and their sirens playing different tunes to each other so that other drivers would realise there were two cars running, not just the one, the crews were receiving updates. One such update sent chills through both crews. The address was a listed Operation Trident location. The occupants were somehow at risk from attackers with firearms. A Trojan armed response unit was already tasked and running to join them, as were the duty officer Inspector Bridgestock and a skipper to act as scene controller. The area car and response car arrived on scene, having run silent for the last quarter of a mile, and the crews deployed to create a discreet cordon to keep the house under observation without being seen. After a few minutes, during which George realised that he was actually watching the wrong house and finally crawled into position to see the right one, the Trojans arrived, followed soon after by the inspector and sergeant, along with a dog van and a couple of other response cars. At the rendezvous point, Inspector Brigstock eyed the unusually all-female Trojan team as they swaggered over toward him. "I take it you're armed then," he muttered. It was the turn of the armed response officers to look at the duty officer in a less than enthusiastic manner, although to their credit they refrained from voicing an answer. After a swift briefing, during which they were filled in with the latest intelligence on the address that the control room had managed to gather together for them, everyone was deployed. A Trojan, assisted by a pair of local officers, were able to get into the back garden unseen and cover the rear of the house, while the remainder gathered at the front door. The area was kept secure with road closures out of sight of the house. Eventually everyone was in place and ready. The front door was opened with the aid of an enforcer ram, and the entry team flooded through the front door, securing each room as they went, quickly reaching the kitchen where they found two CID detectives sitting at a table with the occupier, enjoying a nice cup of tea. Apparently the personal attack alarm had been playing up, and the two detectives had come down to check it, not realising that they'd set it off during their fiddling. The governor launched into a lecture about the use of personal radios and the value of actually turning them on so that their users would be aware of what was happening around them in the outside world, and possibly even preventing situations like this one. After which, everyone, including George, trooped back out of the house for a debrief back at the station. Sadly, the day's catalogue of disasters was not yet complete for George. As the queue of officers returning to their cars turned the corner of the house, most of them noticed the enormous puddle in the road beside the curb, left by the previous night's rain. George didn't. Caught in his own little world for a moment, he failed to notice the car that drove through the deepest part of the puddle just as he passed it. He didn't miss the curtain of water that the car created, nor did the water miss him. George stood stunned, drenched, literally from head to foot, while his colleagues, including Inspector Brigstock, gathered around him. Standing in a spreading pool of water, he turned to his governor with his arms stretched wide, seemingly trying to invoke some kind of a divine intervention, and cried, "I don't believe it." It took several minutes for Mr. Brigstock to stagger to his car, despite the assistance of his sergeant. The two were laughing so hard that they actually looked like a pair of drunks on their way home from an evening of drunken revelry. In fact, it was several minutes before either of them was able to stop laughing long enough for the tears in their eyes to clear and allow them to drive from the scene.
What'd I say? Isn't that fantastic? I want to thank Kevin and Michael for sending us another great story. Remember, though, Michael's extended an open invitation to anyone who would like to write a story, you know, about some of your own real-life experiences. You write it, he'll record it, and I'll play it. Pretty simple. I like the concept. Somebody jump on this thing. Training opportunities. This week, I want to let you know that on October 16th, the Virginia Law Enforcement Canine Memorial will be dedicated in Blacksburg, Virginia. This statewide memorial honors the memory of all law enforcement dogs who have given their lives in the line of duty. Virginia Attorney General Bill Mims will be the keynote speaker during the ceremony that represents the culmination of 5 years of work by members of the law enforcement community and the Virginia-Maryland Regional College of Veterinary Medicine at Virginia Tech. The memorial consists of a life-sized bronze German Shepherd law enforcement dog sculpted by a local Blacksburg artist, who is the creator of the noted Officer Down statue installed in front of the Roanoke City Police Department, the Addison Caldwell statue at Virginia Tech, and several other major installations. If you have any questions, please call Christy Jackson at 540-231-7239. But remember, we welcome training or event announcements from any criminal justice agency or training organization. Just send the information to talkback@copcast.net, and we will be happy to announce your event or your next training course. Job opportunities. We're also pleased to be able to help criminal justice agencies find and hire the best qualified people. This week, I want to spotlight the Fairfax County, Virginia Police Department. They're accepting applications from currently Virginia-certified police officers only. Qualified candidates will be given an oral interview, a background investigation, a polygraph, and a physical and psychological examination after a conditional offer is made. Applicants must provide proof of certification with the application. The starting base salary for entry-level Virginia-certified police officers is $48,368. The top salary level for police officer one is $75,035. You can apply online, and I'll put the link and the telephone contact number in the show notes. Remember, if your agency's hiring, just send us a little information about the job, and we'll be happy to announce it on our next show. Well, I think it's about time we stick a fork in this one, because it's just about done. But I want to thank you for taking your time to listen to CopCast, and be sure to let your friends and fellow officers know about the show. Also, remember, my Twitter name is CopCast, and you can follow me at twitter.com. You can also catch up with the two girls from Utah and Michael, a.k.a. George, on Cops Online at copsonline.com. Shell is Hell's Bunny, Suze is Buckethead, and George is Michael, or Michael is George, or whatever. Check them out in the chat room. Better yet, shoot them a little note. Just send them a message. Please keep the comments coming. And remember, I can always use more CopCast correspondents. So if you see a good story, shoot me an email at talkback@copcast.net. And better yet, if you have a computer and a microphone, send me an audio file. I'll make you a star. But most importantly, stay safe. And always wear your vest. So from the whole crew at CopCast, have a great week.